You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Kelly Evans. It's a wrinkle in time. Investors are torn between two narratives, a vaccine for the long term and shutdowns in the meantime, with the CDC now recommending against Thanksgiving travel. What should you focus on? We'll explore. Plus, from preparation buying to the return of eventwear, the street's number one retail analyst breaks down his three-phase recovery playbook. And a 60% rally for Square, a cashless Super Bowl, Radio Shack, and the ESG push. It's all ahead this hour, but let's start with the very latest on these markets. Dom Chu here with more for us. Dom?
All right, so we're in a kind of holding pattern right now, a very mixed session for stocks overall. The Dow Industrials fractionally to the downside, off by just a little under 0.5% right now. The S&P 500, 35.59 the level right now, down about 0.25%, and some outperformance returning to the NASDAQ stocks. They're up about 0.33%, 11.841 the last level there. One thing that we're watching right now is the outperformance recently, as of late, for small cap stocks versus the large cap ones. Over the course of, you can see this kind of month-to-date period, the white line that we have up here is up 15%. That's the small cap stocks. 9% gains for the S&P 500. That gap has gotten wider. We'll see if that continues. It could be a good indicator that things might be more optimistic down the line for the economic recovery, pending COVID infection rates. And then the stock of the day. This is Tesla, and this is now a record high for this stock. We'll put a gold star up here. The reason why is at this level, 2% to the upside, we're talking about a year-to-date gain of nearly 500%. It is now worth roughly $470 billion, which means at this point, hypothetically, Kelly, if it were in the S&P 500, which we know it will be, it would be the seventh biggest stock in the S&P, just below Berkshire Hathaway and just above Visa.
Oh, my gosh.
That's how big Tesla is, Kelly. So we're going to put Tesla up there. Gold star for them. Back over to you.
Elon Musk, like the third richest person in the world, I can't get enough of the superlatives for this company. And Dom, I don't even know what to do about it. I don't know what to make of it. It just feels a little off, don't you think?
Well, just remember this. Remember back in March at the pandemic lows, this $500 stock was worth $70 back on March 18th, just to give you some perspective for how big that run has been.
Crazy. Consumer Reports not even recommending the Model S anymore, but they're full guns blazing. They're moving full speed ahead. They got the Adam Jonas upgrade yesterday.
Tread cautiously,
Dom, thank
right?
you, sir. Appreciate you highlighting that. Yeah, exactly. Our Dom Chu. Let's turn to this tug of war, broadly speaking, between the short run and the long run on the COVID front. We got more good news today, a vaccine being developed by AstraZeneca and Oxford showing a robust immune response amongst older adults. But the CDC is now recommending against Thanksgiving travel, and United Airlines says it's seeing an uptick in cancellations. Meg Terrell is here now with all the latest for us. Hi, Meg.
Hey, Kelly. Well, that recommendation coming as we've never been in a worse point in the pandemic in the United States. The numbers of new daily cases being recorded now on a seven-day average of about 156,000. In terms of the numbers of people in the hospital, up to almost 80,000 at this point, surpassing the prior two peaks that we saw in the spring and the summer. The numbers of deaths also rising yesterday, more than 1,800. That's the highest level that we've seen since May, when we were really in the beginning of this. Now, let's look state by state. This shows the percent change in COVID-19 cases over the last 14 days. And really, none of these states are under 20% growth, except North Dakota and Hawaii. But if you drill down and actually look at how North Dakota in particular is doing, just because it's not increasing more than 20% doesn't mean it's in a good spot. If you look per cases per million, North Dakota is at 1,600, among the highest in the country. Kansas seeing 2,000 cases per million of the population. New Mexico, almost 1,400. So you can really see that states in the Midwest are being hit particularly hard, but this is really a bad situation essentially everywhere in this country. Let's take a look over to Europe really quickly, because there's some remarkable data. If you look at the line of cases in France, that's the blue line here. That country, of course, started a lockdown October 30th. It goes through December 1st. First, cases have really come down significantly, so much so that the country there, some folks are urging the government to consider lifting the lockdown early, but it doesn't seem like they're going to do that. More news out of Europe overnight from AstraZeneca and Oxford. This is a phase two study, so this is not the same efficacy results that we've seen for Moderna and Pfizer, for example. But in this mid-stage trial, they looked at the immune response that the vaccine induces, and they saw that the level of antibodies and T cells was essentially similar from younger people to older people, which is a good sign at potentially protecting older people from the disease, and that the side effects, injection site pain, feeling feverish, muscle ache, and headache, were also actually less in older people, and that it generally appeared safe, which, Kelly, of course, is important. This was the vaccine that was put on a clinical hold as they investigated safety issues. It does appear safe, but we're going to have to wait for the phase 3 results that tell us how well this vaccine actually works.
And Meg, it's noteworthy to kind of highlight the CDC recommendation for a couple of reasons. First, as you've said, they haven't really done these regular press briefings. They did one today. This appears to be the main reason, don't you think? And how do you expect that to affect the decisions? I mean, all of us are trying to, even those of us just having a few people over are trying to figure out, is it a few too many? And this is gives you a big excuse not to do things.
It definitely does, Kelly. I mean, it was pretty poignant actually hearing one of the CDC leaders on the call saying that he hasn't seen his elderly parents since January, and they're asking him to visit. They want to see their grandkids, and he's not traveling. They're really trying to encourage people to stay home. If they do travel or have guests over, they're encouraging people wear masks inside. I mean, they're really trying to get people to protect themselves. And it is notable that they had this briefing. They haven't had an official one since August. But they said they plan to start having more. So maybe we're seeing a change in the CDC.
I know. I hope he can figure something out with his parents, because that just seems cruel. I understand taking precautions, but maybe there's some, you know, kind of, you know what it's like.
I do. And my parents are out in California, and it's tough to see them. They've gone to sort of heroic efforts. My mom isolated and drove herself across the country and didn't see anyone. And we all stayed isolated, and that's the kind of thing you have to do to avoid, you know, the risks here. It's scary.
Exactly. Exactly. It is. Meg, thanks so much. We appreciate it. Our Meg Terrell. Let's turn back to the market, where stocks are struggling to price in the long-term benefits of these vaccines Meg was just describing against the short-term risks of rising COVID cases and shutdowns. Well, joining me with their advice for investors, Neil Hennessy is Chief Investment Officer at Hennessy Funds, and James McDonald is Chief Investment Officer at Hercules Investments. It's great to see you both. Neil, kick us off here. What's your latest thinking on the market?
Well, I think the market's in great shape. I think there's a lot of value out there, Kelly, that still is cheap, that you can buy, you can own. You just have to put things in perspective. You look at the NASDAQ, it's up 33% this year. But because of six out of over 3,000 have run the NASDAQ by over 60%. You have Apple, you have Facebook, you have Tesla, you have Microsoft, Google. Those six companies ran it all. In reality, instead of being up 33%, it'd only be up 14%. But there's plenty of value still to buy. There's plenty of headroom that seems to come out with headlines, but the market will continue to march higher, although it might be a little volatile in the short term because of the stimulus plan, because of the vaccines that might or might not be there.
Yeah, so Neil, you're betting on Vista Outdoors, Valmont Industries, KB Homes. I mean, the existing home sales report this morning was blockbuster. It was so strong. Does that tell you that this housing market is going to have a tailwind well into next year?
Well, we've spoken about this in the past. I mean, people are moving out of the cities. They're moving out of confines that they're around a lot of people. They're moving to larger homes, Kelly, so that maybe they have a spare bedroom or an office that they can work from home. I don't see that changing in the short term. Then you look at all the outdoor activities, Vista Outdoor. It goes from ammunition to bike helmets, to motorcycle helmets, to Bushnell for range finders on golf courses, because people want to get out of their homes. They want to do things. That's why you're seeing manufactured RVs and boats. I mean, they're all having record years. And so you look at Vista Outdoor that most people don't know, but they have 35 different products for people to use on the outside.
Yeah. And at least for now, we do know that's going to be a powerful demand for several months, maybe even well into next year. James, I know you have kind of a very different take on this market, so let's talk about that. You think we're trading down as much as a 10 to 12% correction on the S&P to around 3,200. Is that right?
At a minimum, we have to look at things in context. And in this current market, the stock market's valuation reflects a ratio of profits to actual stock market prices. That is twice as large as it was at the peak of the dot-com bubble, which means that the spread of the virus, its impact on the economy, the slowdown of profits relative to the rise in the stock market from the stimulus and from the Fed intervention, we've got a valuation here that is simply impossible to sustain. We anticipate a 10 to 12% pullback immediately. We're using VolQ futures to hedge that. Obviously, there are reasons that there are risks in this market. It's not just a valuation story. This market is going to contract. There's stimulus tensions in Congress. There's China regional trade partnership challenges. We anticipate the fourth largest year in pension selling in history as stocks greatly outperform bonds this year. Weekly jobless claims showed economic recovery stagnating. There was weak October retail sales. We're going to have more lockdowns here. And so the consumer holiday spending is expected to decline by 19% year over year. And then obviously, we don't know when this is going to end. We were just discussing our parents and how we're going to reconnect as a community. My mom came and visited me for the first time this year in 2020, and it was challenging. And this isn't just a human issue. It's a revenue issue. We're going to not see the same amount of business that we anticipated in March. We anticipate a recovery here. You know, California, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, they're all closing schools. We're going back into at least a partial lockdown phase. And so there's just no way market prices can stay where they are here.
And so your names, your stock picks you're looking at following a market pullback, as you just outlined, include NextEra Energy, Intuitive Surgical. So a very different portfolio. Neil, do you want to just quickly respond to that as we go?
Well, I'm not going to disagree with James, but the bottom line here is everybody can anticipate that earnings are going to be down because of the lockdown the last 6-8 months. We know that. We know unemployment figures are going to be up a little bit. You know, claims are going to be up, but that's all old news. It's what's going forward. If this lockdown doesn't occur clear across the country after 2 or 3 months and things start to open up, then you're going to see the stock prices catch up to where they should be, which you're talking about the Dow Jones or S&P is about 18 times next year earnings. So it's not overvalued. So I'd stay optimistic. Stay long for sure.
And I think you guys aptly summed up the tension in the market. We were just talking about short term and long term. You can kind of see the two forces pulling each way. Neil Hennessy and James McDonald, thank you both. We appreciate it today, talking markets on the exchange. New York City's public school system is back to all remote learning amid a spike in COVID cases. It's the latest and largest school system in the country to take this step, and it could have big ripple effects on the economy, as James was just discussing. Our Steve Liesman is here now with more on that. Steve?
Yeah, Kelly, the reclosing of New York City schools, a potent sign of what's happening across the country and an ominous symbol maybe of what may be to come for the broader economy. The national index compiled by the online community event company Burbio showing 40% of the 1,200 school districts they track are now teaching virtually. That's up 4 points in just the past week. 2 points are New York City alone. Traditional and hybrid teaching have both declined. Schools in 33 states have enacted full or partial closures in recent weeks, including in Colorado, Texas, Ohio, Indiana, and Michigan, where the governor yesterday shut down the state's high schools. The national county map shows schools in Florida, Texas, Wyoming, and Montana. Those are the deep purple ones. They're among other places in the country that are 100% traditional, and it remains to be seen how they react to the latest spread of the virus. School closures, of course, come along with other business closures and government lockdowns. One of the biggest impacts will be to push caregivers out of the workforce, and that, as we've talked about a lot, Kelly, hits women especially hard and could help explain today's unexpected rise in filings for jobless claims, Kelly.
I didn't realize it was that widespread, Steve.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't either. I mean, I looked at the New York City. We have this Burbio data. We've been following it over time. And then it turns out it's been already happening. Now, New York City is its own thing, right? Because it closed down with a very small percentage of community spread at just 3%. Some of these other places have closed down with double-digit community spread. So New York City is its own thing that's going on there, but it's definitely part of what's happening around the country as well.
All right. Steve Liesman, thank you, sir. Steve, tallying up the ripple effects of all these school closures. Coming up, it's a strong week for retail earnings so far, but are shutdowns threatening to spoil the holiday shopping season? The number one retail analyst gives us his three-wave recovery playbook. Plus, the new administration could give ESG, sustainable investing, a big boost. We'll talk about who that benefits. And the Super Bowl goes cashless. The full details ahead. Stay with us here on The Exchange.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Welcome back. It looked dire for retail back in March, but the sector has proven surprisingly nimble amid the pandemic. Year to date, the S&P retail ETF's gains are more than double those of the S&P, and the top performers in just the past month are actually department stores like Nordstrom, Kohl's, and Macy's. My next guest says that retail's recovery won't be a straight line from here, but he does see three major spending waves coming. With us now is J.P. Morgan's Matthew Boss. He's institutional investors, number one department stores, and specialty soft lines analyst. Matt, good to have you today. Have we started phase one yet?
No, phase one has not started yet. So I think right now you're in the anticipation phase, meaning the COVID cases are rising, retailers have battened down the hatches, and you're seeing a real dichotomy between essential retail, discount retail, and fashion and apparel retail, meaning the winners are more focused on the basics, the winners are focused on value and convenience, and what's losing right now, I think, is what we'll see post-vaccine, which is the future, which is more occasion wear, event wear, return to work. So right now, I think you're pre the wave starting. The way that we map it out is wave one is the front half of next year. I think that's where you see the anticipation or preparation buying for returning to occasions, for going out. I think that's really denim, outerwear, and some occasion buying. Wave two, I think, will be the back half of next year and into 2022. That's where I think it's return to work and more of the events that would be your charity events, weddings. I think there's pent-up demand. And the last piece of this that's on the back end is travel and tourism.
Right. And it's interesting to even talk about event wear because it's been so, you know, it almost feels like a dead category right now. But of course, things are at some point going to look very different. So what do you do with a name like Macy's? I mean, you talk about these retail waves, but we also know there are secular challenges for some of these businesses. I mean, the fact that Macy's in-store comps were down more than 30%, and again, I know expectations were super low. The stock isn't doing that badly today, but, you know, where are you on the department stores versus some of the other names implied in these spending waves?
Yeah, I mean, I think today is a perfect example. We cover LB, you know, that stock versus Macy's, both reported today. LB reported 55% comps at Bath & Body Works and 25% total comps for the overall consolidated organization. Macy's reports negative 21 comps, and to your point, with brick and mortar down close to 40%. And so there's really a tale of two worlds out there. I think the unknown, and I think where you need to be careful, we would rather on the recovery side own the global brands that are sold within the department stores. So we recently upgraded Tapestry. We have a buy on Nike and Lululemon. I would rather own the brands. I think they're in control of their own destiny. I think one of the outcomes of this is stronger e-commerce. E-commerce is higher margin for the brands, but it means greater costs for the retailers. So on the department stores, we remain cautious. I think this was a tough print for Macy's. They're doing a nice job holding the expenses. But 2 years out, we're modeling the revenue base 20% below pre-pandemic.
Ouch. So I guess my final question is, if there are investors who are trying to be tactical right now and say, okay, I take your point, I want exposure to event wear, do I get that exposure now? Do you think it's already priced in? Do you wait for, you know, another pullback if there's trouble on the stimulus front, for instance?
The way that we're thinking about it is a bifurcated approach, meaning I think there are companies that will do well as COVID remains or outperform. To me, that's a Lululemon, an LB, and a Five Below. And then on the back end of it, as I'm thinking about the recovery, that's where, again, I would like to own the global brands, Tapestry being one in terms of playing the global handbag opportunity in terms of the return to occasion, as well as travel and tourism.
All right. Matt, good to have you. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Thanks for having me.
Matt Boss of JP Morgan on retail. Coming up, investors are underpricing part of Square's business, and the stock could soar 60% from here, says one analyst. We'll discuss that call. Plus, help wanted as COVID-19 cases rise across the country. The need for lab technicians is urgent and growing. We're going to look at the challenges the industry faces and what's needed to fix the problem. And don't forget, you can always watch us live on the go or listen using the CNBC app. We're back in a couple. Welcome back to The Exchange. Let's get a check on markets. Dow was down 210 points at the lows. We were briefly positive. We're splitting the difference right now. We're down 91. It's a third of a percent decline. The S&P's down 4. The NASDAQ is still up 45, and that's the feel for the whole market today. Take a look at the sectors, and it's the tech-heavy sectors that are mostly the leadership today. Technology, communication services, discretionary, energy also hanging on to a half percent gain. So nothing major here. Utilities and healthcare, those are the biggest laggards. Lots of individual movers today, including shares of Sonos, which are surging after a beat on the top and bottom line. Sales jumped 15% last quarter. The maker of smart speakers continuing to see strong demand amid the pandemic. Shares are up 26%. Cinemark is lower on a downgrade to hold from buy at Loop Capital. The bank pointing to theatrical windows shrinking faster than anticipated. This on the heels of Warner Brothers announcing it'll release Wonder Woman in theaters and on HBO Max on Christmas Day. Cinemark down 3%. And shares of Coty are rallying on an upgrade to buy from neutral at Citi. They say Coty is still undervalued despite a rally of nearly 90% in the past month. They're saying new leadership is one of the catalysts, and Coty is up more than 18% today, around $6.28 a share. Let's get to Sue Herrera now for our CNBC News update. Hi, Sue.
Hello, Kelly. Hello, everybody. Here's what's happening at this hour. The Trump campaign is dropping its lawsuit to block the certification of ballots in the county that includes Detroit, saying it got the relief it sought. Two Republican members of the county's board of canvassers want to rescind their certification, but state officials say there is no legal mechanism to do that. At a video hearing today, a judge ruled there is enough evidence to charge a 19-year-old man with illegally buying a rifle for 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who allegedly used it to kill two people during unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Rittenhouse tells The Washington Post he got the money for the gun from a government stimulus program. The White House stopped the Justice Department from making a deal last October to pay for mental health services for migrant families separated at the U.S. border. That's a report today from NBC News, which cites four current and former senior administration officials. You are up to date, Kel. That's the news update. I'll see you again in an hour. Back to you.
All right, Sue, thank you very much. Sue Herrera. Take a look at shares of Intel. The stock is hovering close to its 52-week low. It's down 17% in the past month as news for the company goes from bad to worse. Intel beat earnings in late October, but warned of delays in its next-generation chips. You can see the drop that it took that day. Meantime, rivals AMD and NVIDIA posted stellar results. And now comes Apple, which just released new Macs using their own chips rather than Intel's, and reviewers are raving about them, especially how they boost battery life and how cool and quiet they run. Intel is down 34% now from its 52-week high. We're sitting right near the 52-week low of around $43. Still, it sports a dividend of roughly 3%. Intel is expected to give a company update in January. Still ahead, the future of sustainable investing, or ESG. Could the new administration give the industry a boost? And if so, who would that benefit the most? Plus, more enthusiasm for Square. The Super Bowl goes cashless, and is Radio Shack making a comeback? It's all ahead in rapid fire. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. Let's catch you up on a few stories that should be on your radar today. It is time for Rapid Fire. Here to break down the headlines, Bob Bassani, Kate Chuny, and Chuny Rooney, and Dom Chu. Welcome, everybody. It is great to have you all here. All right, first up, Mizuho just hiked its price target on Square to a street high of $300 and reiterated it as a top buy. They're saying that Square's Cash App is aging, quote, like a fine wine. More like a champagne. They're adding new customers much faster than expected and growing in areas of the country that were previously dominated by rival Venmo. Square's up about 2% today, but it has been an absolute monster. It's up more than 200% on the year, Kate. I mean, they're a little late. This reminds me a little bit of the Adam Jonas call on Tesla yesterday. But hey, I guess everybody's realizing the world is Square's oyster at this point, right?
Yeah, 60% upside for this price target. And one of the interesting trends here, I think, was that Google search data that they said that they are taking market share from Venmo and Square originally. And this, they did similar data a couple of years ago, and it was really big in Mississippi and in the South. If they're able to take some of that market share in these bigger cities, these coastal cities like San Francisco and New York, that could be a big deal. It's also a lot more profitable than Venmo, and it used to sort of be a side project. Now every analyst on the street seems to be way more focused on the Cash App than that seller business.
Bob, where are you on the payment apps? I mean, we've talked about the monster performers in stocks like MasterCard and Visa for literally the past decade, and I wonder if Square, if we're passing the baton, and these are the payment stocks of the future.
Well, look at the performance. It's not 200%. Square's up close to 300%. PayPal's, I don't know, half that. And PayPal's flattened out for months now. Square just keeps on going. I find that Cash App that Kate was talking about very interesting, because it looks like they're diversifying away from the instant deposits, which is where all the money used to come from. They're now talking about Bitcoin in this. So they're really disruptive. They're moving really fast to get into the kind of businesses and areas that people want to get into. So as of now, it looks like Square is much hipper than Visa or MasterCard to me.
I agree. And Dom, this is one where I don't really have any direct experience. I mean, I use Venmo. I use Zelle undergirding, kind of using the Chase app to pay people at other banks all the time. But I feel like I guess by the time I adopt it, the run's going to be over.
Well, I mean, it's more the concept, right? You and everybody else out there are using these types of fintech products even more and more. For me, when I look at a company like Square, it seems to me like I'm surprised that nobody has talked about acquiring it yet. Right. And maybe that's kind of the reason it's baked into the stock price the way it is. But this notion here that Square is operating as a platform for doing this kind of transaction seems to me at some point like a banking institution or a much larger payments company or fintech company will look to buy them. I mean, for Square, I tend to use a lot more of these things now during the pandemic. It's one of those habits I think sticks after this is over.
Yeah, it was always kind of the also-ran company. When we talk about Jack Dorsey, it was always about Twitter first, and it feels to me like this is changing, and maybe he's relieved at that as well. So let's stick with payments, guys, because for the first time, everything from concessions to retail is going cashless at this year's Super Bowl. It's part of the NFL's partnership with Visa. Fans who attend the game can use credit cards or apps. If they do bring cash, there are reverse ATMs throughout that will convert it into gift cards. The NFL told CNBC going cashless was already in the works, but COVID-19 sped up that timeline. Dom, my first thought was, I guess that means the Super Bowl is going to have fans actually there, but sure enough, it's in Tampa. I guess they can be around 20% capacity, so that's 13,000 people.
And it's not just that. I mean, so if you're going to go, I thought to myself, how many people are really going to be there? But then you broaden it out thematically speaking. One of the big stats that stands out during this kind of whole presentation of why they're going cashless is how much more people spend when they do it on a card versus shelling out cash. According to Visa and the NFL, it's like 25% more at concessions when they use like some kind of contactless or swipe type payment. People just tend to spend more when it's not shelling out their own cash and counting bills out. It's also one of those reasons why personal finance experts say if you want to control your budgets, use cash, don't use cards, because you can track it better. For me, though, this whole notion of getting more cashless actually is a good thing, because if you can get more of these types of technologies for reverse ATMs, you can start to serve the very underbanked population, not just here in the U.S., but around the world as well. It means everybody can get a card at some point, so they don't have to have that cash around.
Yeah, it seems like it was only a matter of time before we all go.
If it's not cash, it's free money. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, this is part of a process that's been going on for years. I mean, basically in China, they're already practically cashless. You walk up and, my understanding is you go up into Beijing and try to hand somebody cash. They'll look at you like you're crazy at this point. So what does Visa get out of this? First off, they get more revenues, number one. Number two, it seems to me they get really valuable insight into consumer behavior, which I bet you they're going to be sharing with the NFL. The thing that makes me very nervous about this whole thing is just the trend towards exactly them knowing everything about us. Art Cashin, for years, I've been going out with Art for 20 years. He pays cash at every place we've ever been because he doesn't like people knowing exactly what they're doing. That's essentially what what he's doing. That's essentially what we're giving up at this point. But nobody seems to be fighting it too much, at least.
Rooney, quick last word on this.
This is great for Visa. They've been a crusader in sort of getting rid of cash. And if you can get people to physically take cash and put it back into a prepaid debit card, they're going to make more money on these swipes. And like Bob said, the spending data could be huge for the NFL. They want to see what people are doing when they're actually in the stadium. And financial data is a big part of that.
Yeah, now I'm going to be thinking about Art Cashin as we follow that info. All right, moving on, let's take a look at this. The best in America, Radio Shack. Nobody's that is a Radio Shack ad from, I don't know, 1980-something? But the company could be making a comeback, according to the Wall Street Journal. They're saying that retail e-commerce ventures known as REV has acquired the rights to the Radio Shack brand. They've filed for bankruptcy twice in the past 5 years, Radio Shack has, after getting crushed by competitors like Best Buy and Amazon. But they do operate online and with a network of 400 independently owned stores worldwide. REV has also acquired other beaten-down retailers lately, like Pier 1, Modell's, and Dress Barn. They hope to revamp Radio Shack's website in time for its 100th anniversary next year. Bob, is this gambit going to work?
Well, I guess the question is, first off, I love watching that. That was the early 80s. You could tell by the hairstyles. And I spent a lot of time in Radio Shack. All my batteries, I bought computers there. They were really big on personal computers for a long time. There's a lot of nostalgia for baby boomers around this. I guess the question is, what is the strategy? These guys are not electronics guys that are suddenly going to find out a way to sell electronics online. These guys are hoovers. They suck up essentially well-known big brand names that we all grew up with. You mentioned Dress Barn, Modell's. They own the trademark assets of Modell's. Pier 1 imports. So they're buying up brand names and they're going to try to figure out a way to essentially market a lot of them online. I guess the question is, are they going to find strategies that will work for each of them? If they don't, they'll probably drop some of the brands. They bought them relatively cheap. I just see a company that's basically buying up brand names without an overall strategy. That's the concern I have.
Well, Dom, that's exactly what I was going to ask. I mean, you have to invest a lot in each one of these in order to make them viable. That's a tall order, I think, for this firm.
It is. So the whole thing here is this may be a great strategy to counter Bob's point. The reason why is, how much did they actually pay for these brands? We don't exactly know how much they did, but there's a price tag where the deep value play comes in. If you buy it hypothetically for a few $1,000, $10,000, $20,000, it may be a perfect way to get brand recognition for an e-commerce portal later on down the line. So the real question here is, yes, buy up as many of these bankrupt brands as you want. If you're not paying that much for them, it's a pretty cheap bet on trying to get people and that brand recognition back into your e-commerce portal.
I guess I'm with Bob on this one. I'm skeptical it'll work. We'll see. All right. Finally, guys, Marissa Meyer, she says she's going to fix your contacts, your address book, that is. The former Yahoo CEO has rebranded her startup firm Lumi Labs to Sunshine and launched its first official product called Sunshine Contacts. It's an app meant to help you organize, update, and share contact information in a more user-friendly and efficient way. She co-founded Sunshine in 2018 with the goal of using technologies like AI to improve the apps we use every day. Now, Kate, I love this concept. I went through all of my own contacts with the help of my diligent husband, who explained, you know, there's like three different servers that they're all on. I mean, there were thousands and thousands in there. And it really is, you know, and I tried to plug it into the car and then it says there's too many and we can't. So as we're integrating all of these things into our lives, there is a need for something like Sunshine Contacts. But how successful do you think it can be?
It's so true. I did the same thing. I looked on my phone for some of these repeats. I had something like 15 taxi and cab companies that I haven't looked at, you know, in probably 8 years. I agree. I think it could be really useful, but how are they going to make money? Who's going to pay for that? And is it that it's really not something top of mind until you read a story like that. You're like, oh, that could be useful in some way, but I don't know what the revenue model is. Can you advertise on that? And will people actually pay a subscription? It's really not that much of a daily issue, right?
Bob, let me get this straight. You want me to let an artificial intelligence rummage around in my phone trying to figure out how it can improve it? What could go wrong with that? I don't know. I can't imagine. I'll pass.
I think we need more of Bob's like real world like reality check on all of this on Rapid Fire every day. Dom will give you the last word.
All right, here's what I would say. I would say, yes, I was skeptical, but remember, cataloging data, making sense of all of it was one of the reasons why companies like Oracle and Microsoft made it huge back in the day. Database management was then. This could be now. I mean, yes, you're letting sensitive information into the hands of others, but in some way, if they can make it more efficient, this could be something that works out in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, Google has all of mine anyway, Bob. I don't know. Maybe it'd be better if little old Sunshine has it, right?
But that's the incrementalism. Oh, they already know everything. We might as well give it to them. My Social Security number is known by everybody. I might as well, you know, write it on my front door. No, it's really, there's a point at which it gets a little bit creepy. Every time you have an app, they ask you, could I access your camera? Can I access your microphone? Yep. Can I access your mother's home address? How about no? No, you cannot.
I agree with you.
Sorry.
You're like, it's Chipotle. Why do you need all that? Anyway, all right, we got to go, guys. Thank you so much today. Bob Bassani, Kate Rooney, and Dom Chu.
Okay.
Still ahead, President-elect Biden's victory has put renewed attention on ESG investing, what it means for investors, and whether companies and ESG funds are really socially responsible. That's next. And the increase in U.S. COVID cases has triggered more testing around the country. We'll talk to the supervisor of 37 labs in Georgia about what she's seeing and the challenges they're facing coming up. Welcome back to The Exchange. Assets in U.S. sustainable funds are nearing $200 billion as of the end of the third quarter. They've more than doubled in less than 3 years. And with the Biden administration expected to put a spotlight on ESG investing, the trend looks set to accelerate even more. What does it mean for investors? For more, I'm joined by Henry Fernandez. He's the chairman and CEO of MSCI. Henry, it's great to have you here. What do you expect under a Biden administration?
It will be a huge spotlight on sustainable finance and investments, much more than during the current administration. You know, to begin with, I believe that the Biden administration will join the Paris Agreement, and therefore, from the federal government perspective, there will be a lot of leadership in terms of combating climate change. That's going to percolate throughout, you know, every part of society in America, including corporations and other issuers. So that's one big change. The second one is that the Biden administration will obviously focus a great deal on the pandemic and the impact on the health and well-being of people in the country, and especially the employees of companies. And therefore, companies are going to have to be very focused, continue to be focused on that. So that will be another spotlight. A third one, and a very one is social issues like racial injustice and the like. So the Biden administration is going to be all over this, and that's going to have an impact on the response of companies.
One of the concerns people have is that ESG funds, can attract a big following without people knowing exactly what they're signing up for, and that companies themselves are adapting to try to be ESG friendly no matter kind of what industry they're in, including some surprising candidates. Here's what Burton Malkiel told our Bob Bassani about that a few weeks ago. Henry, take a listen.
My concern is I don't know what's a good company and what's a bad company, and neither does anybody else. Is the utility that burns coal a bad company because it burns coal, or is it a good company because it's doing an enormous amount of investing in wind power? I don't know that any ESG broad-based fund is really one that makes me feel confident that I'm investing in really good companies.
Henry, what would you say? I mean, he's one of the great investing minds alive today.
You know, he is, and I have a great deal of respect for him, and I took him as a student of economics at Princeton. But I would beg to disagree. A lot of what we do, for example, is to try to understand what are the material factors in ESG considerations that will affect the performance of a company. So, for example, if you have a company that has a very hostile working environment, discriminating against women and other minorities and the like, that is not a company that is going to attract a lot of customers, a lot of employees. And they won't be able to hide because that information is now much more relevant around the world. So will that be incorporated immediately into the stock price of that company and the cost of capital? Maybe, maybe it will take time, but over time, for sure, it's going to affect the, you know, the, its business. Similarly, you know, if you're polluting the environment, similarly, if you have bad governance and the like. So I think that a lot of these issues, particularly the material ones that affect the performance of a company, need to be taken into account into any investment portfolio.
Well, and to your point, I mean, you guys do kind of these rankings, what we're used to seeing on the credit side, so that perhaps you can incorporate some of that information. I have to leave it there, Henry. I appreciate you joining me today. There's a lot more to unpackage. I know we want to talk some China as well. If you'll come back, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Henry Fernandez from MSCI. He is the CEO there. Still ahead, it's been a problem for two decades, but the pandemic has exacerbated the shortage of lab technicians. Up next, we get a look at one lab that is understaffed and still processing 1,000 tests a day. The Exchange will be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. A decades-long labor shortage in the nation's medical labs is being exposed by this pandemic. 1.5 million COVID-19 tests are being processed in the U.S. every day, and the need for testing is growing. New cases topping 170,000 in recent days. Hospitalizations are at new highs. The Augusta University Medical Center labs in Georgia have been open 24 hours a day since the spring. 25 lab techs are handling about 1,000 tests each day, and their system has 50 job openings. Brandy Gonzalez oversees the 37 labs, and she joins us now. Brandy, it's good to have you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
My first question before we get into what's happening at your labs and specifically is, could the U.S. do testing much more quickly for everybody if we had a lot more capacity? I mean, are you constrained by how much you can physically process every day?
Yes, we have several constraints. The two biggest ones are supply chain and then staffing. And staffing has become a really big issue, especially here recently. The supply chain has been there since the beginning, and we've had issues with that, but it's really the staffing has become the biggest hurdle for us to overcome.
And so we mentioned this, but you guys have about 50 positions open. So let's put this in context. That's about 30% of your positions are open, and you think 20% of your workforce is going to retire in the next few years?
Correct. We actually have staff that have retired and come back and have joined, rejoined our workforce during COVID to help with the situation that we're dealing with right now. We even have one manager that has been here for 45 years that has retired and come back because we're under such a severe workforce shortage.
I know that you yourself got into this not necessarily as your first career. So what needs to be done to get more people in? I mean, obviously the easiest thing is to raise pay, to raise wages. You know, are you having to do that? And do you expect that in order to pull people into this industry, that that's going to be one consequence?
Well, there's two big things. One, raising pay obviously would help attract more people to it. But a lot of people don't even know that we exist. Laboratory testing is more in the basement. And when most people go to their doctor, they see nurses, they see doctors, they see their pharmacists, but they don't really see the laboratory professionals in the background. So there's a lot of people that do not know that you can't just get a biology degree necessarily and go work in a medical laboratory in a hospital. It's actually a specialized degree, either medical laboratory science or clinical laboratory science, depending on the school. And the problem is that since people don't know that we really exist, people aren't really going into the field. We've had a lot of people not going into the field, and as a consequence, a lot of the schools have closed, having some issues with funding as well.
Wow. What happens with people in terms of the medical checks they need to pass in order to work in these labs in general? You know, what happens if they have pre-existing medical conditions? I mean, what are sort of the standards there, generally speaking?
So as far as pre-existing, you know, we try to not put someone who has a pre-existing lung condition right there doing COVID testing. But as far as the rest of the testing, it's perfectly fine. Unfortunately, we also have such a severe shortage that we have to put people where we can. We're very heavily reliant on traveler technologists right now and medical laboratory scientists. And even with that, it is still having staff that are pulling double shifts just to get the testing necessary for our patients.
Yeah, well, it's definitely put a spotlight on this part of the medical field and how much it could help all of us if you guys had more bandwidth right now. Brandy, thanks for joining us and for everything that you've been doing.
Thank you.
Brandy Gonzalez of the Augusta Medical Center. Before we go today, take a quick look at shares of United. They are falling nearly 2% after the airline said there's been an uptick in cancellations as COVID cases spike and as people cancel holiday travel plans. The CDC just recommended against Americans traveling for Thanksgiving this year. They said compared to last year's fourth quarter, United expects capacity to be down 55%, revenue to be down 67%, and again, the shares trading lower on that today. That does it for the exchange, but stick around for Power Lunch, because as COVID cases spike, the hotel industry is bracing for more pain ahead. We'll have a look at some of the staggering numbers they are warning about. I'll join Dom Chu for that after this quick break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.